We have started Yom Yomu.
Okay, another
So far, we've gotten through the first.
Yeah.
It would help if I was in the right book. There we go. Right. So far, we have gotten through the first pasuk. We haven't really resolved the first pasuk. We've just kind of identified the problems inherent in this first pasuk. Ben shana she'uba malcho, u'shtei shanim malach ha'Yisrael. We spent last week talking about the challenge of understanding this text at face value, because if you just take it at face value, Shaul is a year old and he reigns for 2 years, and nobody's going to assume that that is in fact literally the case. And so we need to resolve both halves of this verse. How old is Shaul, or why the text obscures his age when he assumes the throne? Ben shana she'uba malcho, and how long he reigns for 2 years seems to be an unacceptably short amount of time to address all of the various pieces of Shaul's story. So we offered several suggestions last week, if you remember. What were they? Let's see how much we remember. Test people's memory. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Right.
Came for a year.
Right. So one suggestion, various themes along the way. There's the Midrashic suggestion that Ben Shana is a kind of spiritual assessment of how pure and how wonderful and how free of sin and how perfect he is, which is somewhat challenging for us. Certainly not intended to be the pshat of the pasuk. I don't think Chazal meant it as the pshat. And second of all, it also is somewhat difficult because Shaul has his baggage too. So we suggested, based on the Yerushalmi, that really can be understood not so much as Shaul was kind of pure and free of sin, but that were free of mistakes, but that starting off as king kind of cleans the slate and gives everybody an opportunity to start afresh. That's on the level of Drush. The level of Pshat, we saw two possibilities. One is that means that he had a year had passed since the previous story, and now begins the story of his reign, and he reigned in total for 2 years. So that's one way that was Rashi's understanding of the text. And the other suggestion was that there was a kind of a assessment, a year had passed since the first coronation or since the previous parak, either way, and now in the second year, this is what's happening. Shtei shanim malach Yisrael, 2 years he had reigned over Israel, when the continuation of the events of Perek Yud Gimel unfolded, the Battle of Michmas. The third possibility I suggested at the very end of the Shir, which was based on a somewhat obscure commentary in the 13th century called of Tanchum Yerushalmi, who suggests that that the age is missing. That Ben Shana She'ul B'Malcho is really Ben blank Shana She'ul B'Malcho. That in keeping with the structure of this verse as it appears in the rest of Tanakh, that in fact his age should be there. It's not. And it's not, although I don't necessarily know if he says this is intentional or not, but it would seem it's not intentionally. In other words, every other king's age is identified, including David HaMelech, several chapters later, but by Shaul it's missing. And that opens up the question as to why the chronology of Shaul's reign is couched in obscurity and mystery. So why does the Tanakh intentionally hide from us the context of his chronological history, how old he is, how many years in fact he reigned, right? Even 2 years is somewhat of a mystery. It's not right. We have to say it's either 2 years until David took the throne from him, or he lost it, if you will, in the Battle of Amalek, or some other context of 2 years till the Battle of Michmas. Unclear, but what is clear is that the chronology of Shaul's reign is couched in mystery. a starting point and ending point, and we don't have necessarily at this point a resolution as to why. So I left, that was the question we ended with, and we're going to pick up from that question today. Yeah.
Rabbi, I have a theory that just like, say, for Shmuel is a transition between Shoftim and Malachim, that Shaul is a transition from, you know, being the first king. So he, like, starts the model, but he's not there yet. That is my thought.
I hear you.
It's a transitional figure.
Even transitional figures should have. Why wouldn't you tell me their age? Why wouldn't you tell me how long they reigned for?
Right? Yeah.
So, like, just because they make a transitional figure, why did that mean that we're going to hide his age in chronology?
Are we going to find out the mystery?
Well, we're not going to necessarily resolve all of it, but we're going to. I'm going to offer a theory as to why I think there's a mystery. But he is a transitional figure, but not intended to be transitional. In other words, I think it's important to recognize that what worked out in the end is not necessarily what was intended. Adam and Chava ate of the Eitz HaDaat, that wasn't necessarily what was intended from the beginning. It just worked out what was worked out in the end. Right? So what worked out in the end isn't necessarily a reflection of what was intended to be. What was intended to be was Shaul was intended to be the first king in the beginning of the dynasty of Israel. And had he succeeded in the challenges that were placed before him, which I believe he had full capability to do, then he would have established a dynasty of Malchut Yisrael for generations to come. There's some suggestion amongst some commentaries that Malchus was promised to David, to Yehuda, not to Binyamin. Shaul was from Sheva Binyamin. Eventually, the Malchus is going to have to shift from him and go to Sheva Yehuda, and that maybe the Malchus started from Binyamin specifically because the first king wasn't going to succeed, and therefore you needed to wait until you could have a successful king, which would have been the second king, namely David. I don't buy that theory. I don't buy it because it takes away Shaul's choice, his bechira. Shaul, for all intents and purposes, has all the ability and promise and potential to succeed. How to address the Shevet issue, the promise to Yehuda over the promise to Binyamin, there are other ways to do it. I'll remind us just briefly that David HaMelech was Shaul's son-in-law. And you don't have to remove the throne from Shaul to put his son-in-law on the throne. So it could have easily have gone from Shevet Binyamin to Shevet Yehuda without a moment's pause, without having to go through the process and the anguish of Chayt. So was he intended to be a transitional figure? I don't know. It's a difficult question, but my intuition is that he's the all intents and purposes was he was supposed to be the beginning of the dynasty of Israel. But all right, we still have this mystery. Why is his life couched in? Why is the chronology couched in obscurity and mystery? I'm going to leave that question for now. We will, Bezrat Hashem, I will share with you what I think intuitively by the end of today's shir. But to do so, we need to first delve knee deep into Perek Yud Gimel. That's what we're going to do next. Let me just pass one of these out. From here forward, much of what we're going to be looking at in Sefer Shmuel is going to be geographic, and therefore a sense of the geography and a sense of what's what in the topography of Israel is very important for us. We have our trusted map. This map is quickly coming to an end. But for now, it'll serve us. And you now also have a handout of a karta map of this parak. בן שאול, שנה שאול במחול, שתי שנים מלך הישראל. ויבחר לו שאול 3,000 מישראל, והיו עם שאול 2,000 במכמס ובהר בית אל, ו1,000 היו עם יונתן בגבעת בנימין. ויתר העם שילח איש לאוהליו. Shaul took 3,000 people from Israel. 2,000 were with him in Michmas and Betel. 1,000 were with Yonatan in Givat Binyamin. The rest of the people he sent home. Does anybody have a clue what's going on?
He divided his forces.
Why?
I have no idea.
Right. Okay. Just, right?
He's going to war, but it seems like he doesn't want everybody. He wants only a select.
Takes 3,000 people, splits them into two, 2,000 with him in Michmas and Betel, 1,000 with Yonatan. What war?
Where did this war come from?
We don't know how many
are the rest.
Are the rest?
We don't know that.
Not a clue. And what war? It almost sounds like we're in the middle of a story. Mm-hmm. Right? Like it begins in the middle of the story. Now, one of the clearest indications that it begins in the middle of the story is Yonatan.
Where did he
go? Because who is Yonatan?
Where did he come from?
Where did he come from? Who is he? Forget what we know, because we know much more than we should know. Right? But if you're reading the story, remember the assumption is you're reading the story sequentially. Who is this Yonatan? Now, it's clear from the rest of the story, because Yonatan will talk about his father. It's clear that Yonatan is is the son of Shaul. We know that later on. If you take a look at the end of Perek Yedalad, you'll see the introduction to Yonatan. Very end of Perek Yedalad, Pasuk Mem Tet, 49. Vayu b'nei Shaul, Yonatan v'yishvi u'malkishua, v'shem shtei v'notav, v'shem ha'bechira meira, v'shem ha'ktana michal. We are told that Shaul has 5 children, Yonatan, Yishvi, Malkishua, 2 daughters by the name of Merav and Michal, and we have, he has wives, Vishem Eshet Shaul, Achinoam ben Achimatz. He has a wife, Achinoam ben Achimatz. He has a general, Shem Tsar Tzvao, Aviner ben Ner Dod Shaul, Vikish Avi Shaul, Viner Avi Avner ben Aviel. These are his generals. So he has generals, he has... This is a king, right? A king has a royal household.
So why aren't they introduced beforehand?
Right. Why aren't they introduced beforehand? And in most cases, they are introduced beforehand. Right? In most cases, if you go back to that list of kings that we read through last week, we didn't go through the whole list, but it's not uncommon to introduce a king by his age, by the years of his reign, by the names of his wives, and the names of his children.
His mom.
Right? And which mother the child comes from.
Right.
So all of that's here, but it's at the end of the Perek. For some reason, the story of Perek Yedalad begins, Shaul took 2,000 to Michmas, he gave Yonatan 1,000 to Geva Binyamin, the rest he sent back.
But you don't even know
who is Yonatan, what war are we talking about? We are entering into this story in the middle. Is that clear?
Yeah.
There's a piece of the story at the beginning that we are unfamiliar with. We don't know. Pasuk Gimel. Vayach Yonatan et Netziv Plishtim Asher Begeva. Back to Perek Gimel, beginning of the Perek. Vayach Yonatan et Netziv Plishtim Asher Begeva. Yonatan smote the outpost of the Plishtim, which was at Geva. Vayishmu Plishtim, the Plishtim heard. I don't think that means that they just heard. I think it means that they heard and responded, reacted. When the Plishtim heard that Yonatan had taken out the outpost at Geva, they weren't pleased. V'shaul taka b'shofar b'chol ha'aretz lemor yishmu ha'ivrim. Shaul blew the shofar out in order to gather forces. The Ivrim should hear. Who are the Ivrim? On the face of it, we'll assume for now that they are the Hebrews. We will spend a shiur talking about who the Ivrim are, but that's down the line. V'chol Yisrael shemu lemor yika Shaul et nitziv plishtim. All of Israel heard. Shaul had attacked, had smitten the outpost, the Netziv, in Plishtim, of the Plishtim. V'gam nivash Yisrael ba Plishtim. Israel was nivash ba Plishtim was
despicable in the eyes.
Oh, okay.
Our definition is odious.
Odious.
Odious. There you go. Odious.
Odious.
V'yitzaku ha'am acharei Shaul ha'Gilgal. People all followed Shaul down to Gilgal to begin this campaign. Uflishtim ne'esfu lilachem Yisrael, and the Plishtim gathered to wage war with Israel. In other words, what's essentially going on right now? What are we describing the process of?
Is this the background of when we're getting coronated in Gilgal?
No. This is after. That's done. That's past.
Gathering the
beginning of the war. This is the war that's about to break out. Shaul is gathering his forces in Gilgal. The Plishtim are gathering in Michmas. It's a big gathering. Right? This is, right, there was a, let's call it a war of attrition up until this point, until somebody struck first. Who struck first?
Plishtim.
Yonatan took out the garrison of the Plishtim in Geva.
He's like,
okay, took out the garrison of the Plishtim, and that's it. That was the straw to break the camel's back. The Plishtim heard. They're gathering their forces in Michmas. Shaul went down to Gilgal to gather his forces, and the story unfolds. Now, Shloshim, who are these Plishtim? Plishtim ne'esu li'lachem im Yisrael 30,000 rechev v'sheshet alafim parashim. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 riders, v'am kochol asher al sfat hayam larov, and soldiers as far as the eye can see. V'yalu v'yachanu b'michmas kidmat bet aven. They encamped in Michmas on the eastern slopes of Beit Aven. V'ish Yisrael, Pasuk Vav, V'ish Yisrael Ra'u, Israel saw, Kitzar lo, Kinegas ha'am, that they were greatly oppressed, that the people were distressed, meaning they were in trouble.
They were outnumbered,
they were outgunned, they were outmaneuvered. I will just already make one simple observation. We're going to come back to this observation at length a little bit later. But when the story begins, where is Shaul and where is Yonatan? In the very beginning of the story, who's where?
Yonatan's at Geva.
Right?
And Shaul's at
Michmas. And Shaul is in? Michmas. When the story begins, Pasuk Bet. Where is Shaul? Michmas. And where is Yonatan?
Geva.
And where are the Plishtim? Somewhere, not yet.
They're all over the place.
Well, not yet.
Oh, okay.
Right? The Plishtim, where does where does Yonatan smite the Plishtim?
Geva.
In Geva. The Netziv of the Plishtim is in Geva. Correct? So he takes out the outpost of the Plishtim, and then the political political wheels start to turn, and the war cries start, and so the forces begin to gather. Shaul gathers his forces where?
Michmash. Oh, Gilgal.
In Gilgal. And the Plishtim gather their forces?
Michmash.
In Michmash. So look what happened. What happened?
Shaul retreated.
Right. Shaul retreats to Gilgal.
Where is Gilgal?
Oh, where is Gilgal? Gilgal is in the valley, in the Jordan Valley. Gilgal is near Jericho.
Okay.
Over here.
Right. Michmas is in the mountains.
Gilgal is over here.
Okay. Michmas is in the mountains. Which means that between Pasuk Bet and Pasuk Vav, Shaul has retreated to the coast to begin, to group his forces together. But in so doing, now who's sitting in Michmas? The 30,000 chariots of the Plishtim, which is in itself odd that the chariot should be sitting in the mountains, but that already tells you right, where is the strategic high ground in a battle between the mountains.
But it's so funny because the Plishtim are usually at the Chob, aren't
they?
They
are, certainly are, which is another mystery in the story. Because suddenly the Plishtim, they're on the coast. Right, the Plishtim generally don't venture into the mountains because their chariots, which is their tools of war, don't necessarily work well in the mountains. But they have been known to do so. Look, how did the Plishtim take out Shiloh back in Perek Dalet, right, by venturing into the mountains? Shmuel pushed them back. They're sitting in Beit El. Michmas is here on the eastern slopes of Beit El. If the Plishtim are here now and Shaul is here in Gilgal, then what has happened here politically and militarily is a complete turnaround from the beginning of the story. Right. So that's a mystery in itself that we need to understand. He seems to retreat off the high ground. And that gives
far.
The retreat... It is very far. And that gives the Plishtim the window to enter into the world of Michmas. This is a very strange story. It starts in the middle. Shaul is in Michmas. And within a very short period of time, as soon as the wheels of war begin to turn,
he retreats
down to Gilgal, which inexplicably, yet, we'll see. There is an explanation, we will see. Then we get to Pasuk Vav. Ve'ish Yisrael ra'u ki tzar lo ki nigasa am. When Israel saw that they were greatly oppressed and distressed, vayitchabu ha'am b'me'arot u'b'chalachim u'b'asla'im u'b'tzrichim u'b'barot. The people began to hide, and they could hide, and they hid wherever they could hide, in the caves and in the cisterns and the basements and wherever they could find a nook and cranny. The Israelites ran.
Are these the soldiers, or are these just the general population that we're talking about?
How many soldiers are we talking about? B'sach HaKol, he had 3,000 soldiers in the whole story. So
it's the people.
And he sent everybody else home. It's not clear. V'ivrim avru et ha'yarden eretz gad v'gilad. It's most likely a description of the Israelites, not the soldiers. But the Ivrim, who are also part of the Israelites, we'll talk about who they are, they also ran. They ran to the other side of the Yarden. They just ran as far away as they could to get Gad and Gilad. Shaul is in Gilgal. So here's the picture. Shaul is in Gilgal with his army. The garrison of the Plishtim fell, but the Plishtim regrouped and now are sitting with 30,000 chariots in Michmas and Har Beit El. And the rest of the Israelites are watching this horde of Plishtim enter into the heartland of Israel, and they begin to run. The people follow Shaul into Gilgal. They're sitting there.
First.
Who?
Shaul. They're following Shaul, right?
Yes.
They're just sitting. They're following him to Gilgal. Meaning now he's in Gilgal.
Right.
He's in Gilgal with whoever's left of his people. The Plishtim are in Michmas. We're in a standoff. Vayochol shivat yamim lamoed asher Shmuel. Shaul is waiting. Why is he waiting? He's waiting in Gilgal for 7 days because he's waiting for that time that Shmuel told him he would come. We'll talk about that story, if not today, next year. I skipped a line. V'lo ba Shmuel Gilgal. Shaul is waiting and he's waiting and he's waiting and Shmuel is not there.
M.I.A.
V'yafetz ha'am me'alav. And the
I think it was Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Howard.
And the people begin to disperse. Vayomer Shaul, hagishu alai ha'olah v'ashlamim. Shaul said, okay, I can't wait for Shmuel forever. we need to start this war. Can't start without the korban, the ola and the shlamim. So bring it to me. I'll take care of it. Notice ola and shlamim. Vaya'al ha'ola. He brought the ola. What happened to the shlamim? You have a meeting here?
Sorry.
Okay. Just close that. Okay. Vaya'al ha'ola. The ola. He brought the ola. Vahi. As he finished to bring the ola, meaning he hadn't even gotten around to the shlamim yet, Shmuel shut up. Shaul goes running out to meet him and to bless him. Shmuel looks at him and he says to him, "What did you do?"
You're talking about the sacrifice part, about the retreat here.
No, the sacrifice part. Vayomer Shaul, ki ra'iti ki nafatza amelai v'atalabata l'moed hayamim. I've been waiting for you. Waiting and waiting and waiting. You told me you would come at the end of 7 days. This is day number 7. The sun is setting. It's like the 11th hour. I can't wait forever. And the people, and you didn't come. Uflishtim ne'asavim michmas. The flishtim are gathering in michmas. Every day allows them to gather more forces. Ve'amar ata yardu plishtim elai Gilgal. Now if the plishtim come and attack me down here in Gilgal, ufne Hashem lochiliti, and I haven't yet had a chance to offer the korbanot to begin this war, that would be terrible. Ve'tapak. So I had no choice. Va'aleh ola. So I brought the ola. No way, says Shmuel. You've made a terrible mistake, Shaul. You did not listen to the command that God gave you. You were commanded in specifically and explicitly to wait for me. Had you listened, God would have given you this kingdom and this throne for eternity. But now, your kingdom will not endure. God will find somebody who will follow his heart. God's heart, meaning the will of God. You're done. And God will command him to be the leader of his people. You did not listen to God's command.
Did Shmuel come late as a test? Was this a test for Shaul?
I'm assuming so. We shall see. I don't think Shmuel came late, in fact. But we'll see.
So he came like at the very end.
He came at the 11th hour.
Right.
It's like Moshe. Yeah?
The parallel to Chet Egel is very striking. Parallel to Chet Egel, in fact, one of the things that I will look at, there's a textual parallel to Chet Egel, too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of parallels to Chet Egel.
Could it be done out of fear? Like he was getting nervous? Because
of course he was afraid. Of course he was afraid.
He's getting to the point where, well, he hasn't come yet, so...
Of course he was afraid.
So you're making it, but it sounds like it's such a negative thing, what he did.
Yeah. It was a negative thing. It cost him the kingdom.
Yeah.
Now and in the future. It cost him the malchus.
But you can't you understand what where he's at also, or not at all?
Now, there are two schools of philosophy when it comes to reading Sefer Shmuel. There are those who sympathize with Shaul, and they empathize with Shaul. Poor Shaul, he always got the raw end of the deal. God was always hard on him. David was always hard on him. Everybody was hard on him. Poor Shaul. And there are those who empathize with God.
The safer choice.
The safer choice of God, but the truth of the matter is you can't see there could be another point, though. I see both. I mean, I see them both.
The man, this was his Nisa. Now, where did this test come from? Where was this instruction? Where, yeah, that we have, okay.
Okay, so,
so I will show it to you.
Well, this is the same thing.
I will show it to you today.
It happens over and over.
Well, this is the first time. Yeah. It'll happen to him a second time, and then it'll be the end of it. This is almost like a warning shot. He'll do the exact same thing again when he doesn't listen to the letter of the instruction given to him by Amalek.
That's already a different story, because that's the second time.
It's the same chet.
No, but I'm saying...
But it's the same... Right. So this is the first time. This is his warning shot.
But he was warned at both coronations to follow Hashem.
Correct. Correct. This is not out of a vacuum.
No, right. But I'm just saying,
if you haven't figured it out, by the way, I'm of the second school.
Yeah. Right. it didn't take much for us to figure it out. That was pretty...
Vayakam Shmuel Vayal Mina Gilgal. Shmuel left. Okay, I've done my thing. Shmuel says, I brought my korbanot. I've given you your test. You failed. I've given you your warning. Shmuel leaves. Out of there. Goes to Givat Binyamin. Vayifkod Shaul et ha'am nimtzeim imo. Now, after 7 days of waiting, Shaul takes a census of how many people he has left in Gilgal. Kishesh Murtish. And he's left with 600. 600.
From 3, and he's coming
from 3,000, assuming.
And how many thousand are coming after him, too?
V'Shaul v'Yonatan b'no. Shaul and Yonatan, his son. Now already we're told who he is.
Now it's telling.
V'Am ha'nimtza'im am yoshvim b'geva b'nyamin. So Shaul, Yonatan, his son, and there's a group of people with Yonatan in Geva Binyamin. Uflishtim chanu b'michmas. So here's Shaul in Gilgal with 600. Yonatan in Geva with a group. 1, it's unclear.
Does he still have his 1,000?
We don't know. And michmas with its hordes.
30,000.
No, 30,000 chariots plus the horsemen.
Plus horses, plus, 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 yeah, plus, plus.
That doesn't even count the inventory. Yeah.
ויצא המשחית ממחנה פלישתים שלושה ראשים, הראש האחד יפנה על דרך עופרה אל ארץ שועל, וראש אחד יפנה דרך בית חורון, והראש אחד יפנה דרך הגבול הנשקף על גד הצבועים המדבר. The plishtim in Michmas began to move, and they divided their forces into three groups, three platoons. One headed east, one headed north, one headed west, and they're out on a mission to destroy. As if that's not enough, Pasuketet, notice the parenthesis, mm-hmm. notice the open right. paragraph, meaning this is almost like a parenthetical observation. V'charash lo yimatzeh b'chol Eretz Yisrael. In the entire land of Israel, there were no smiths. Why do you need a smith?
To make weapons.
You need a smith to make weapons, right? To forge weapons of war, you need a smith. There are no smiths. Why are there no smiths? Ki yomru plishtim, pen yasu ha'ivrim cherev v'chanit. Because the plishtim would not allow it. See, the plishtim were always concerned that the Israelites would use these smiths to make tools of war. And so they would never allow Israel to have their own smiths. So what did they do? They required anybody who needed. Now you need smiths to make more than tools of war. You also need smiths to make tools of agriculture, and in an agricultural society, that's a critical thing. So, by controlling the smiths, you limit the ability of Israel to manufacture weapons, but you still have to allow them to be able to manufacture tools for agriculture. And so, their suggestion, the solution, was the following. Vayardu kol Yisrael haplishtim lelutosh ish et macharashto ve'et ito ve'et kardumo ve'et macharashato. If any Israelite needed smiths to make tools of war, the tools of farming, they would have to go down to the plishtim. And the plishtim had complete control over the guild of the smiths, and you would have to
go there.
Ve'aita p'tzivapim lemacharashot ve'laitim v'lishlosh Kilshon ula kardamim ula hatziv hadarvan. That's a pasuk that we'll spend some time talking about, but not today. What is various prices related to how much it would cost to make various types of tools? The end result was v'haya b'yom milchemet, on the day of this war, v'lo nimtza cherev v'chanit b'yad kol ha'am asher et Shaul v'et Yonatan. These 600 people with Shaul and this, let's assume 1,000 with Yonatan, they don't even have arms. There are two swords and spears in this army. They belong to Shaul and Yonatan. And the plishtim are moving through Mavar Michmas. That's the picture of the war. The war itself is in Perikid Dalet. Perikid Gimel is the picture, Tmunat Matzav, as we say. Right? Strategical analysis of the situation.
Well, how did Yonatan capture Gilgal if they had no weapons of war?
This is this story is a mystery from start to finish. Mystery from start to finish.
Okay.
I assume it means no good tools of war. I mean, obviously, had some, must have had something like left over, hidden something. That probably means
new
state of the art, yeah. Sharp, ready to go tools of war. Everybody else had clubs and sticks and stones.
Nice, okay.
I'm assuming that's what I mean.
Slingshots.
And slingshots. And slingshots, which were actually a very effective tool for the army in those days. That is the picture. Now, the irony of this story, right, is there are a lot of pieces of the story that we need to resolve and we've left open. But think about just the strategic picture of what the land of Israel looks like at this moment.
Parallels.
Okay. So first of all, where are the Plishtim?
They're in the heart of the country.
Okay, so they're in the mountains. Not only are they in the mountains, we have this Geva of Plishtim this Nitziv Plishtim in Geva, which means that we have Plishtim sitting here in the middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but more importantly, think of what is the political picture of a country where the military apparatus, the skilled workers necessary for creating tools of war, are controlled by the enemy.
Not good.
So what does that say for the? What's the first most fundamental concept of independence?
Strong defense.
Good army.
Political independence means, at a very basic level, is the ability to defend yourself and the right to bear arms, the right to have arms. How do you have a country with a king? The king. Where you can't manufacture weapons because the Plishtim won't let you? Think about the consequences of that for a second. You can't manufacture weapons because the Plishtim won't let you? It's a remarkable picture.
How did it get to that point?
That's the question. How did it get to this point? There's Shaul and his army. It's 3,000 soldiers in total, 2,000 with him in Michmas, 1,000 in Geba Benjamin. He retreats to Gilgal. He's left with 600. Shaul has 1,000. The Plishtim are sitting with 30,000 chariots in the heartland of the country. And what we'll see from the rest of the story is you know, the kind of guerrilla warfare they have to launch. This is a very strange picture, especially for a country that has just recently embarked on its independence and established its own king and its own army. And I will remind you that one perek ago, was the story of Shaul's battle against Nachash Melech ben Amon at Yavesh Gilad. Not only was it successful, I want to go back to that story for a second. That's in Perek Yud Aleph. Let's go back to Perek Yud Aleph. Pasuk Hey. V'nei Shaul ba acharei bakar min ha-sadeh. If you remember the story with the people from Yavesh Gilad, they come to the Israel, they're being threatened by Nachash Melech ben Amon. They come, they tell the story that they're being threatened. Shaul has not yet been crowned by the people. The coronation, second ceremony hasn't happened yet, but the first one has. Shaul comes in from the field. They ask him what's going on. He tells them the story of the people of Yavesh. Pasuk Vav, Vatitzlach Ruach Elokim al Shaul, Kishomot Advarim Eila, Vayichar Apo Ma'ol. Shaul is overwhelmed by the Ruach Elokim. He hears this, he gets angry. Takes his bakar, cuts it up, sends it off to the people. Remember, reminder of Pilagish Begiva. Says, if you don't follow Shaul and Shmuel now into battle, this is what's going to become to you. They come in unison. He takes a census of how many people showed up because he sent them a message. Vayu bivnei Yisrael shlosh meot elef yishudah shloshim alef. 330,000. Now the number could be an exaggeration. I don't know.
But what happened to it?
But 330,000. We're talking about a representative sample of 10 to 20, 30,000 from each tribe. From every shevet, ke'ish echad. And they take this marching war of entire army and march, and Yavesh Gilad, and Yavesh Gilad crumbles beneath them, Nachash, Melech, and Amon, crumbles beneath their feet within hours. Break it off. From there they go to Gilgal, L'chadesh Shama Melucha. From there, Shmuel's big farewell speech. Perek Yud Gimel in Michmas, Shaul is in Michmas, Yonatan is in Geba, there are 2,000 soldiers, 3,000 soldiers, there are 600 soldiers, they don't have a sword, they don't have a shield, they don't have a spear, so the Plishtim won't let them have forces, have smiths, and it's completely topsy-turvy world. What happened between Perek and Aleph and Perek Yud Gimel? There is no logical, rational way to read these prakim in sequence.
So this is later.
Understand the problem? The picture, the strategic picture, the tumunat matzav of the state of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, in Perakid Aleph, in Perakid Bet, right? To borrow a phrase, the state of our union is strong. In Perakid Gimel, the state of our union is collapsed. Under the pressure of the Plishtim. The Israelites are hiding. They're running into caves and into nooks and crevices and crannies. The Ephraim are running across the Arden to run away. The whole country is crumbling. What happened? One Perek. How did that happen? That's a mystery.
We have all these questions.
So, I don't have a definitive answer to this mystery. But I'll tell you what I heard from Rav Meidan, which I think has a lot of have compelling impact. What happened between Perek Yud Aleph and Perek Yud Gimel was that it rained. It rained.
Meaning,
you have to look bigger. Meaning, let's go back to the story that I left, one of those unresolved mysteries I left you with at the end of the story of the rain in Perakid Bet was we talked about various explanations to what this rain is and what the symbol of an ot is and why Shmuel made it rain in the middle of the harvest. And I suggested to you then that there was one more observation about this rain that we were going to come back to. And that is that if you take a country that is an agricultural society and you destroy its economy in one fell swoop, you wipe out its economy, what happens to its military strength?
Falls apart. So there's no way to feed him or pay him.
So here's Shaul at the height of his kingdom, the height of his power. 330,000 soldiers. They gather in Gilgal. And remember what Shmuel is struggling with. He's struggling with the fact that the people want the army because they want to be free of the spiritual accountability that the book of Shoftim was all about. They want the army. They want that strength. That 330,000 people that Shaul took out to battle against Shaul, that's exactly what they want. That's perfect for them. But it's exactly what Shmuel is afraid of. It's exactly what the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want. Because the jump from there to Kochi v'otzem yodi asali et achayel hazeh, this is my victory, is very narrow. And so there's a constant theme back to the world of the kings to get them to recognize that it's God who fights their battles and it doesn't make a difference how much military strength they have, and ultimately they need to engage in battle with the kind of emunah and bitachon that they had in the days of the Shoftim. I'll show you one verse in Perek Yud Daled. When Yonatan attacks the garrison of the Plishtim at Michmas. Forget Shaul for a second. Shaul is sitting in Gilgal. Yonatan and his na'ar, his lad, his assistant, the two of them by themselves attack the entire garrison of the Plishtim.
What verse are you at?
To Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Yonatan el na'ar nose kelav. Yonatan says to his what do they call him? Armor bearer. Right. David was the Nosei Kelav of Shaul for many years. Right? Armor bearer. Lecha v'nabra el matzav ha'arailim ha'ele. Let's go against, let's attack this outpost of these arailim, which is a pejorative for the plishtim. Ula yaseh Hashem lanu. God will be with us. Ki en la'Hashem matzor lo shia b'ravam b'ma'at. If God is going to help us, it doesn't make a difference if we're many or if we're small. What difference does it make if we attack 30,000 chariots? What difference does it make if we attack with 2 soldiers or we attack with 1,000 soldiers? It makes no difference. Ultimately, it's in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we're going to go and attack. Now, the rest of the story we'll read another time, but understand the mindset. That's the mindset that Shmuel is looking for in the Melech. And what he gets is Shaul, who goes to attack Yavesh Gilad with 330,000. And the people are cheering. And that's exactly why they came and requested a king in the first place. Ki ra'u ki nachash melech b'ne'amon ba'alechem. So Shmuel says to them, in the end of this long speech, it's raining. It's the middle of the harvest. It's going to rain today. And a rain like they haven't seen. Kolot, Elokim, Ubarad, hail, and it destroys the crops. It's a devastation. We don't know the aftermath of that rain. We're not told. All we know is that the story stops there and picks up at the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel in the middle of the story of the war with the Plishtim. Now take a strategic picture. Right? Imagine for a moment it's seen in the movie where the scene changes and there's some kind of a transitional fade in to fade out, and you realize that you've missed a whole bunch of pieces in the middle, because from this big coronation ceremony, the next scene is the middle of a war and they're losing.
Badly.
And you ask your question, what happened? Well, the only thing we know that happened was that it rained, destroyed the crops. It was more than just destroy the crops. It destroyed the whole infrastructure of the country, and everything that they had built came collapsing down on them. The mystery is we don't know how much time transitions between Perek Yud Bet and Perek Yud Gimel. But we do know the time has transpired. How do I know time has transpired? And it's got to be more than a year. It's got to be more than a year. Even though the Mefarshim say Ben Shaul, that's the Ben Shana Shaul B'Mocho, that's the year. It's got to be more than a year. I mean, the truth is that you can devastate a country economically in less than a year. You can turn a country around militarily and politically in less than a year. It doesn't take more than a year for the political climate to turn upside down, for the Plishtim to have always been there, sitting and waiting for the time to pounce, to come back and be sitting in the heartland of the country, and for the entire picture to turn upside down. My intuition is that I think it's more than a year. And the reason I say that is because by the time Perek Yud Gimel opens up, we're already reading about Yonatan, Shaul's son, who is leading a garrison of soldiers. Shaul, in Perek Tet, when he was looking after his father's flock and he was going to look for his father's donkeys, doesn't sound like a man in his 40s or 50s who's got a son who's a soldier in the army. Perek Tet reads intuitively like Shaul is a young man. Perek Yud Aleph, Perek Tet and Yud is one story. Perek Yud Aleph is the... Now, again, there are transitional times between Perek Yud and Perek Yud Aleph again. Shaul comes back from the field after that coronation, first coronation. Shaul went home and everybody went home. We don't know how much time transitioned before Shaul came back and the story of Battle of Michmas took place. But it couldn't have been that much time, because remember, it was the war with Nachash Melech Ben Amon that was the catalyst to the request for a king in the first place. So that's all connected to the first part of the story. And Perek Gimel opens up with Shaul as an has a wife and children, as son, is a general in the army. So there's this gap in the number of years. My sense of it is that that gap is reflected in the phrase Ben Shana Shobamacho, or Ben Blank Shana Shobamacho. I'm not telling you how old he was. The chronology here is obscured in the same way that the story of the destruction of Israel, the near devastation of their economy, the devastation of their political structure, the devastation of the Malchus, it's all crumbling away. When Shmuel comes to Shaul and he says to him, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you, it's not just because of his failure at Gilgal. His failure at Gilgal was destroyed to break the camel's back. It's because, to a certain extent, Shaul allowed this to happen. And the picture is a devastating one. Now, they'll turn it around because Yonatan's righteousness, etc. They'll turn it around and they'll be victorious against the Plishtim because we're here to live the tale, live the tale to be able to tell it. But that's right now the challenge. So I suspect that that's the transitional bridge. That this Geshem B'Yom Katsir, this rain, did more than just wipe out that crop. And that in fact it was the symbol of a devastating punishment to the people.
For wanting a king?
Oh, so let's take that step one step back. Remember that the wanting of a king in itself wasn't the chait. That was clear back in Parakhet, when they came in the first place. Wanting the king by itself wasn't the core, the crux of the chet. So if we go back to the consequences of it, and the question of whether in measure for measure, whether the punishment was
fit the
depth of the crime, think about it like this. When they first come to Shaul and they say, we want a king. Shaul's immediate response is Shmuel, and they say we want a king. Shmuel's immediate response is,
"What about me?"
Right? He was very angry. He took it very personally, and he was very angry. Then God comes to him and he says, "Oh, you've got nothing on me. Right? You've got nothing on me. If anybody's supposed to be angry here, it's going to be me because this rebellion isn't against you; it's against me. Now, rebellion against God is." Treasonous. I mean, that's a Venezuela. That's devastating. Whatever the nature of that rebellion is, it's not just because they wanted a king. Okay, we'll give them a king and we'll say, well, let's hope for the best. Right? If you rebel against God, that's Chaita Ego. There's a reason why this story is compared to Chaita Ego. Chaita Ego here looms over the story like a it just hovers over the whole piece. There's a reason why we compare this to Chet Ego. The devastation is equivalent. So what is it about what they did that was so horrible that the consequences of which were the near destruction of Israel? So one piece of it was that they wanted a king, in a sense, to reject the kingdom of the Rabbanu Shalom. They wanted a king because they wanted to free themselves of the consequences of having to be constantly relying on God. Talked about this before, the Sefer Shoftim style. That in itself is a rebellion. It's equivalent to being Avodah Zarah. Right? I don't want to have to worship God. I don't want to have to serve God. I want an army to protect me. That's a terrible, theologically a terrible thing to do. And God gives them a king, but then he says to them, okay, this is serious consequences.
This doesn't change anything, really.
Add to the fact that there's another level to their rebellion. And that was the rebellion against Shmuel. And as much as God said to Shmuel, don't worry about it. Much worse against me. But the reality is that there was a rebellion against Shmuel because of his sons, because of what they'll do, etc. They took Shmuel out of office. They retired him early. Remember, that was part of the theme of Perek Yudbet, was that they retired Shmuel early. Now, that also has consequences. Why does that have consequences?
They lost their spiritual leader.
So Shmuel was certainly their spiritual leader. He was their Navi. Although he'll stay in that capacity as their Navi for years to come. He says that. He makes that commitment to them.
But here he was supposed to do the Alim, and Shaul replaced him, and he obviously didn't have the connection to God, so his war went very badly.
Right. All correct. Add to all of that one more piece of what the consequences of taking Shmuel out early. What was Shmuel's major life's work, effort, campaign? What was Shmuel, in the essence of his core, what was Shmuel's life's task to be?
To bring all on Israel together.
Bring back Shiloh?
No, Shiloh's destroyed right at the beginning, but the consequences of Shiloh's destruction was part of Shmuel's life's mission. The consequences of Shiloh's destruction should never be underestimated. It hovers over all of Sefer Shmuel. Why was Shiloh destroyed?
Because of the sons of Eli.
Catalyst was the sons of Eli, the corruption, the straw that break the camel's back. At the base of it, why was Shiloh destroyed?
They were worshipping idols.
350 years they were worshipping idols. All of Sefer Shoftim. Remember that Sefer Shmuel opens on the heels of the failure of Sefer Shoftim. 350 years of Avodah Zarah, the cycle of Sefer Shoftim is a devastating indictment. They can't free themselves of that Avodah Zarah. The ultimate consequence, Shiloh is destroyed. Comes along Shmuel, whose life's work is what? His life's work can be summed up, right? His life's work can be summed up in the opening psukim of Perek Zion. Israel sighed after God. If you return to God with all your heart, get rid of the idols from your midst, get rid of the Ashtoreth and the Baal, be loyal to God, serve him by himself. The primary threat in the land of Israel, you want to save yourself from the plishtim, serve God. That was Shmuel's life's campaign ambition. If you fire him prematurely before he finishes the task, what ends up happening?
Fall apart.
Then all of the foundation that you had, the tashtit, the foundation of that Avodah Zarah that you haven't gotten to, like a seed, like a weed in a field that you haven't taken out the seeds, right? They will grow back. And it may take a generation. But it's not a surprise that Avodah Zarah will reintroduce itself back into Israel one generation later in the days of Shlomo HaMelech. Had we eradicated it once and for all, maybe it wouldn't have come back. But you took out Shmuel at the height of his career, when he was working, his life's ambition was to remove the Avodah Zarah from the land, was to bring the people into tshuva. Then you come to Shmuel and you say, you know what? We've had enough of this tshuva business. We want an army instead. And understand the consequences. So you put all of that anticipation on the role of the king to regroup and to lead that tshuva campaign, but with what? With an army of 300,000 soldiers? And the people can go home after that and sleep well in their beds and not have to worry about anything? So Shmuel says, okay, let's go to Gilgal. Remember, Gilgal is the symbol of
crying.
Right, the crying of the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Right. Gilgal is the symbol of Sefer Shoftim. Shmuel strategically takes them back to Gilgal and he says to them, Rabosai, it's a terrible thing you've not because you asked for a king by itself, but because of the context of the request for the king, the premature nature of that request, out of time, so that you didn't finish the campaign against Avodah Zarah, so you haven't established the theology that's necessary for the foundation of the king. All of the pieces are there for failure. Now, you want to make the, you want this king? Here it is. But you've got to pay the price of this king. You want to serve God? Serve God. But this is complicated. And it rains. And they can't regroup from that devastation.
And it's so subtle, you don't see it in the text. You don't even realize that that's what...
You have to sort of take a step back from the two stories and put them next to each other to see how far afield we have gone from Parakeet Aleph, Yud Bet, and Yud Gimel, Parakeet Aleph and Yud Bet to Parakeet Gimel. And then you need an explanation of this. There might be other explanations, but it's very difficult to read these stories in sequence and say, okay, we go from the war against Nachash with 300,000 soldiers to the war against the Plishtim with 600. So that, I think, is sort of two out of the three loose ends that I still owe you, which is an explanation of the consequence, the historical consequences of the rain and the transition, the Ben Shanash Ubamachol, the transition of the period of history, and why the chronology is obscured. The chronology is obscured because this whole gap is not there. It's not in the text. Much as, and this is interestingly a kind of characteristic of Sefer Shmuel, the other devastation in Sefer Shmuel wasn't in the text either. Namely, the first major churban in Sefer Shmuel was the fall of Shiloh. That wasn't in the text either. Remember, we had to find that in Sefer Tehillim and link it back to the story of the capture of the Aron, but the text skips it completely, even though it was a major consequence. Everything is affected by it. It's not in the story. And here you have a second example of something. That's exactly the question we're going to look at. Here you have a second example of a major period of catastrophe
that's missing
in the story. Same author. You sort of get a sense that Shmuel is kind of his devotion and his love is so deep that even in his rebuke and the consequences of that rebuke, he can't bring himself to write it.
Like there's too much trauma around it.
Right. He can't bring himself to write it. He was the one who predicted the fall of Shiloh. As a young boy, he knew the fall of Shiloh was coming. He didn't want to tell. He didn't want to tell Eli. He was forced to tell Eli. And then when it happened, he doesn't write it. Doesn't include it. Yet there's an enormous gap between Parakeet Bet and Parakeet Gimel with a devastation, political devastation, military, economical, everything is turned upside down. Doesn't write it. Obscures it. Ben blank, Shana B'mocha, I won't tell you how old he is, because he'll figure it out somehow. He won't do it. It's a remarkable story, because part of that is Shaul's... Do it again. Thank you. Keep me on my toes. Right. Part of that is Shmuel's unbelievable love for the people to the point, and Shaul too, where he can't even record the prakim, the chapters that describe that devastation. It's really remarkable. So it kind of hints to them. He hints to the fall of Shiloh, and he hints to Shaul too. Right. He loves Shaul. Right. He's not covering for Shaul, but his pain at Shaul's mistake is palpable. Is palpable.
So if Shmuel's sympathetic to Shaul, you can't blame for being all sympathetic.
No, absolutely not.
Thank you, Jen.
Absolutely not. Shmuel was very sympathetic to Shmuel. Shmuel, on the other hand, delivered the message right between the eyes. Shmuel had to, because he had to. But that's this piece of the story that's missing. Now
that was his tough kid.
Now I have 5 minutes left. So in 5 minutes, I want to show you one more piece of the story. And the one more piece of the story is. Remember, I indicated we saw that we entered into this middle of this battle with the Plishtim. We don't know how it started. But it sounds like it was a rebellion against the Plishtim. It was like a I don't know, a war of independence. The Plishtim are in control of the country.
An uprising.
An uprising. The Plishtim are in the control of the country. The Plishtim are in control of the smiths and the guilds. And there comes a point where Shaul is the king. He's got to do something. Yeah. So he launches an uprising to free Israel from the yoke of the Plishtim. And that's exactly what this is. It's been described as Mohammed HaShikhur of the Israelites against the Plishtim.
The Jewish spring.
Okay. Now, the question becomes, in my mind, whose strategy is this campaign? Who orchestrates this campaign? Who conceives it? Who navigates it? Who mandates it?
Shmuel.
Shmuel.
That's a surprise.
Shmuel.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that.
Shmuel. How do I know? Yeah. How do I know? Okay, I have 3 minutes to do this. How do I know? Go back to Perek Tet. Perek Tet. Remember Perek Tet? Mm-hmm. I'll tell you in a second. Perek Tet is when Shmuel and Shaul first meet. Remember that story of the donkeys?
Yeah.
Shmuel and Shaul first meet. So first of all, right from the beginning, Perek Tet, Pasuk Tet Vav, God says to Shmuel, Vashem gala et ozen Shmuel yom achad lifnei bo Shaul lemor. Shmuel had been told by God one day before Shaul showed up, saying, tomorrow at this time I'm going to send you something about somebody from the land of Binyamin. You will anoint him over my people. Next words. Voshia et ami miyad plishtim. Shaul has one mandate. Real mandate, meaning not fake mandate, not the people's mandate. The people's mandate was to fight against Nachash Melech Bnei Ammon, 300,000 soldiers. That wasn't God's mandate. God's mandate was to free the people from the yoke of the Plishtim. For that, they need a king.
So it's continuing what the whole book of Shoftim was also.
Correct. It's a continuation of the story of Shimshon.
Yeah.
And the period of the dominion, that's what I was looking for, dominion of the Plishtim, is likely a continuation from the period of Shimshon. Remember, Chana's prayer. Chana's tefillah. Yes. I'll make him a Nazir. Why will I make him a Nazir? So he'll finish the job that Shimshon began. Yes. Shmuel was fired prematurely. So if Shmuel wasn't going to finish it, Shaul would have to. Do you follow what's going on?
Yeah.
Now, we're not finished.
So basically that yoke is idolatry. I mean,
the sin of the people of idolatry, but the political yoke is the yoke of the Plishtim. And we're not finished. Take a look at Shaul finally comes, and Perek Pasuk Chaf Hei, same Perek Tet Pasuk Chaf Hei, Vayerdu Me'abama Ir, they come down from the stage, from the dais, Vayedaber Im Shaul Alagag. Shmuel took Shaul up to the rooftop, and they spent a night. All night long, vayashkimu, vayikalot hashachar, all night long, till morning dawn, discussing the geopolitical situation of the land of Israel. What do they talk about all night long? There's only one thing to talk about, which is Shaul's mandate as king, which is defeat the Plishtim. At the appropriate time. Now, Perek Yud, before he leaves him, he gives him a series of tests. Remember the tests? One test, you're going to meet two people coming from Kever Binyamin Asher Gvul Binyamin Kivurat Rachel B'Gvul Binyamin B'Tzaltzach. Then you're going to go Pasuk Gimel, you're going to go from there Perek Yud, Pasuk Gimel, you're going to go from there and you're going to meet two people coming from Har Tavor or three people and they're going to be going up to the Beit El to bring Korbanot. Pasuk Hey. Achar ken tavo givata elokim, and then you're going to go to givata elokim, asher sham nitzivei plishtim. That geva of Binyamin, where there are nitzivei plishtim, is referenced back in Perek Yud. And there you're going to be transformed through the Lakat Nevi'im, through this group of prophets. You're going to be transformed. You're going to be transformed into a different person. And after that, Pasuk Zion, when these three signs come true, then you do what you need to do because God is with you. You will be successful. Then you come down to me in Gilgal. I will come to you to bring olot, to bring shlamim. Shivat yamim tochel ad bo'i elecha. You wait for me for 7 days till I come. V'dati lechat asher taseh. I will instruct you on how to conduct this battle. This is the command that Shaul was commanded to obey when the war with the Plishtim began. And so he's sitting in Michmas, opposite the Geva Binyamin and the Plishtim, sees the beginning of the rebellion, recognizes that this was that moment that Shmuel talked about so many years earlier and said to him, when the battle begins, you come down and you wait for me in Gilgal.
But he didn't wait.
Well, he comes to him. He leaves the high ground. He abandons the strategic high ground. Why? The people are looking at him and saying, Shmuel, what are you doing? When you're in Michmas, why are you going down to Gilgal? Because Shmuel told me. I have to obey Shmuel.
So then
I come down to Gilgal, abandon the strategic high ground, goes down to the valley. Why are we doing here? We're gathering our forces. Why? Now the Plishtim are going to take Michmas. The Plishtim will take Michmas. We'll come back. How long are we going to wait? We're going to wait. Why? Because Shmuel told me to wait for him for 7 days. Shmuel told me to wait for him for 7 days. When? 5 years ago? 10 years ago? 20 years ago? 30 years ago? When the battle against the Plishtim begin, you come down to me in Gilgal. That was exactly what he said to him. So 30 years ago, he gave him this instruction. Now the battle against the Plishtim has begun, and he's waiting for Shmuel. 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. He said, 7 days. Okay, sunset is 7 days, 6 o'clock. 4 o'clock comes, 4:30 comes, 5 o'clock comes, 5:30 comes. The people are like, they're all gone. 3,000 chariots are sitting now in Michmas because you abandoned the high ground. You've got 600 people left. And you're waiting for what? For a Navi who told you 30 years ago you wait for him for 7 days? And so he says, enough. At the last second, brings the korbanot, and Shmuel shows up.
But why does Shmuel come late?
That was the test.
The test.
That was the test he gave him back in Perek Tet. He says, you have one test. And the test is how loyal will you be to the letter of God's command.
But he said 7 days.
7 days.
In other words, 7 days. Ken made it all the way to the
half hour before the end of the day. 11th hour.
Wow.
How many hours? By 40 days after Mamad HaSinai, how many hours did they miss Chet Ego by? Or did they miss Moshe by? Much more to be said, but B'ezrat Hashem, we will continue this story when we get back.